Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, the hot debate in Washington and beyond over the treatment of terror suspect detainees is not the one the White House expected, not Republicans versus Democrats over who's tougher. Instead, it's been a debate over effectiveness and morality, with key GOP leaders debating each other. Globally, U.S. forces now hold 14,000 detainees beyond the reach of established law. The symbolic center of that system sits at Guantanamo Bay, and there, commanders, guards, and detainees have been involved in a long-running negotiation of their own, with crackdowns, softenings, prisoner attacks, hunger strikes, and suicide. Up next on Point, while Washington debates, we'll go deep inside the facts of life at Guantanamo. We'll turn in a moment to Tim Golden and the Guantanamo story, but joining me first today from Washington for an update on the detainee debate and talk of compromise is Charles Babington, congressional reporter for The Washington Post. Charles Babington, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
So the battle lines here, how do they look? Several very hot days into it.
Yes, it looks that they're drawn pretty sharply. Both sides seem so well dug in, it's hard to see where there's a lot of room for compromise, despite all the talk of compromise. But right now, in the Senate anyway, it looks as though the John McCain forces have the upper hand, and that's because probably all or virtually all of the 45 Democrats in the Senate will be with him, and that means he doesn't have to pick up very many Republicans to give him a majority, and it's like he's already picked up those. So barring some change of heart among some of these Republicans or Democrats, I think it's a tough go for the president in the Senate.
Now, yesterday, the president's national security advisor, Stephen Hadley, saying on the Sunday talks that there's negotiation going on and there's room for something here. Take us right down to where the rubber meets the road. What would require compromise? Where's the exact point where they'd need to compromise, and does it look possible?
Well, that's so hard to say. I've got to say, all last week, people on both sides kept saying the same thing. There's a very possible compromise. We're getting close, and at the end of the week, There'd been no movement at all. I think everybody's compromise idea was that the other guy will compromise. So I'm not sure that that anything has changed. Obviously, these are closed door negotiations, and something could happen. But where the biggest problem is, as you noted in the outset here, was this interpretation or clarification of the Geneva Conventions. And McCain and his allies, John Warner and Lindsey Graham and so forth, are convinced that the president's approach would invite other countries to reinterpret the Geneva Conventions as they wish, and to the detriment of American servicemen and women at some point down the road.
Potentially torturing those men or women somewhere
down the road.
Exactly,
and that's really what we're talking about. People dance around that word, but that's clearly what we're talking about here. And, of course, one problem that the president faces is that, particularly in John McCain, who, as we all know, was a Vietnam War POW and was tortured by the North Vietnamese, he has so much, credibility and stature on this point that if he were just, a run-of-the-mill senator, it might be a different matter.
Well, George Bush and Dick Cheney, far less on the Vietnam War veteran path, at least.
That's true. And, of course, also siding with McCain, John Warner, chairman of the Armed Services Committee, was also secretary of the Navy and served in World War II, and Lindsey Graham's much younger, but he has been a military JAG or attorney. So he has a lot of expertise in the legal matters. So
is interrogation the final sticking point here, or are they still stuck as well on detainee trials, on what could go into those trials and before?
Yes, that's still an issue, Tom, although it seems to be lesser than the Geneva Convention issue. But you're right, and probably the biggest sticking point on the trials is this notion that the president is very adamant about, that in some cases where the only information that you would have to convict one of these detainees would be classified information, that information could be shown to his attorney, but the attorney would not be able to share it with the suspect, and that perhaps some type of redacted or summarized version of the information would be given to the suspect. But Lindsey Graham and McCain and others have said that this just turns our notion of a fair trial on its head, that we would never tolerate not only in our civil and criminal courts in our country, but we would never tolerate one of our people in another country being convicted on information that he was never shown.
What about camps evolving around this issue? John McCain was in New Hampshire over the weekend. Of course, he may be looking toward a presidential race himself. He said while he was there, and of course, Colin Powell came out last week concerned about the U.S. moral standing in the war on terror. John McCain said former Ronald Reagan era Secretary of State George Shultz is with him on this. Do you see evolution? Do you see people changing sides or just digging in where they stand on the issue? Chuck Babington.
Yeah, I don't know. It does seem, I saw the thing about Shultz, but again, my sense from what happened last week is that everyone who's already stated a position on this will just look to the people who is on his or her side and say there's more, you know, reason for me to hold my position. I think that, you know, there's a fascinating, you mentioned McCain in New Hampshire, there's a fascinating political element here. As we all know, he's probably at this point, very early point, the Republican front runner for president, but of course, his dilemma, because he is seen as something of a maverick, is that he's got to get the hardcore Republicans to support him in the Republican primaries. And he's been, as we all know, has been kind of moving to the right and shoring up his base for some time. But this seems to be taking him in the opposite direction. He got blistered in a front page editorial by the union leader in New Hampshire. So this could be detrimental to his chances of winning the Republican nomination.
Conservative paper there. And finally, Chuck, President Bush said last week, well, it will be my way or no way, essentially, on interrogation here, that if he doesn't get what he calls clarity around this, he's going to shut down interrogation. Is that realistic? Has the White House softened on that?
They've not softened a bit. Stephen Hadley repeated that same point over and over yesterday on the Sunday talk shows. What McCain, and it may very well be that they will shut down this, and then, again, keep in mind we're talking about this so-called special program involves only CIA, we're not talking about uniformed, the military.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been, you know, very controversial in these so-called, you know, dark or black prisons in other countries. McCain and others say, look, we can have perfectly adequate interrogation programs and abide by the Geneva conventions. And I think he's basically said, if we have to, let's call the president's bluff on this. It may not be a bluff.
Still a big thicket. Charles Babington, congressional reporter for The Washington Post, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Joining us now from New York is Tim Golden, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The New York Times. His big story, The Battle for Guantanamo, appeared in this weekend's New York Times magazine. Tim Golden, it's been a long time. Good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Tim, we've got a big story that you share with us here about what's gone on kind of out of sight of most Americans. It's an unbelievable, sort of fascinating, detailed story. But step back with us here for a second. You're talking about events of the past several years, the back and forth between prisoners and the commandant at Guantanamo and prison guards there. How do you see this whole story playing into what's going on in Washington right now? The intimate life of Guantanamo, the big public policy debate in Washington. How do they relate?
Well, about 2.5 years ago, in the summer of 2004, after the Supreme Court decision, the first Supreme Court decision on detainees, which was Rasool, the administration stepped back and essentially said, we are not going to be able to hold these people outside American law. We're going to have to do it differently. They're going to have lawyers. They're going to have access to information that they hadn't had before. And that really started an enormous change in the way Guantanamo's life proceeded. The result was a shift from a focus on interrogation to a focus on longer-term detention. Most of the guys who were there had been there at that point already for more than 2 years. So there wasn't an enormous amount of information for them to get, according to a lot of the intelligence people. And the idea was, now you're going to have to hold people for a very long time. They're dangerous. Mm-hmm. We're not going to be able to send them back to their home countries or otherwise dispose of them. So we're going to be stuck with them. And the experiment began to unfold really at a sort of a ground level and to some extent out of sight, while all these other issues of legal standards, of treatment, interrogation rules, the CIA black sites were playing out in the headlines. Hmm. The question of how you're going to hold a bunch of men who many of whom are not ever going to be charged, who have no clear way to affect their detention, who are not necessarily ever going to be released, is a huge question that we still face.
And you remind us of the intimacy of that process of holding men. It sounds antiseptic, but it's not. We'll dig in and look at the details of that in a minute, Tim. But how do you think prison guards and commanders at Guantanamo are following this debate? Where do they see their interest in this whole thing?
You know, I think they wake up every day and start their 12-hour shifts feeling like this is very remote, like that one thing is the legal standard and then Geneva Conventions and the sort of discussion of this. But I think they are very much focused on avoiding problems, keeping the lid on. And that's very much the story that I found at Guantanamo.
Tim, introduce us to Colonel Mike Bumgarner, if you would. Take us back to when he stepped into a leading role at Guantanamo and what he faced.
Colonel Mike Bumgarner was a career military police officer who was sent down to take over as essentially the warden, the head of the guard force, in April of 2005. Mm. And he's a kind of a fascinating post-Abu Ghraib figure in the military. He's sort of a good old boy from North Carolina. Mm-hmm. He played quarterback for his high school football team and ended up dropping out of West Point. But he wasn't one of these soldiers of whom I've met a good number who went down to Guantanamo to get their piece of the war on terror. Mm-hmm. I think he was ashamed by the abuse scandals in Abu Ghraib and quite determined to try to win back the country's respect for the armed forces. And I think he's a very representative figure in a lot of ways.
Now, he came into a situation where sort of the foundation stone was President Bush's declaration, as you remind us, that after 9/11, that the U.S. would not be bound by any part of the Geneva treaties in dealing with prisoners in the fight against terrorism. So what did Mike Bumgarner find at Guantanamo?
Well, it's fascinating because you had a debate going on in Washington, which we didn't really glimpse until months later, over common Article 3, the minimum standard of the Geneva Conventions. It's common to all of the Geneva Conventions, and that's why it's called common Article 3, that prohibits degrading and humiliating treatment. Meanwhile, a provision of the conventions, really the third convention governing enemy prisoners of war, which was a sort of World War II era set of rules for what you do to run a prison camp with enemy soldiers from another government or another country, was really sort of not even under discussion. That was precisely the sort of rule book that the Bush administration had set aside, saying this was totally inappropriate for terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
What the guys on the ground did was to say, well, you know, this is what we know. Let's go back and start seeing what we can take from this.
He had more or less instruction from his commanding officer, the overall commander of the Joint Task Force at Guantanamo, Major General J.W. Hood, saying, as you convey it, let's see if we can't get Guantanamo a little closer to Geneva Convention standards.
That's right. I don't think the problem as it was seen in Washington was let's move toward this international standard, quite the contrary. But there was an issue of how can we avoid the kind of problems that will continue the bad publicity for Guantanamo, and the how of it was really left to the people on the ground. General Hood, who had, I think, been to some extent sort of scarred by the legacy of General Jeffrey Miller, who was the man who really kind of shaped up the Guantanamo task force and later advised the prison interrogation unit at Abu Ghraib, and was roundly criticized for that, was somebody who I think General Hood kind of didn't want to endure what General Miller had endured, and as a consequence, he was quite. I think he was willing to experiment. He was willing to try things that were not necessarily straight up ordered from Washington in order to make things better.
But leaving the how to the people on the ground is a huge thing to leave in their hands. And you describe in great detail how that unfolded. Tim, take us into the kind of hallways, cells, exercise grounds, and relationship between guards and detainees at Guantanamo last April when Colonel Mike Bumgarner arrived. Give us some of the texture of that.
Well, when Colonel Bumgarner took over, a new group of Navy and Army prison guards had just started or was just rotating in. And I think, as is common, the detainees were testing them. They were pushing them to see how far they could go. And in some sense, this is kind of a metaphor for everything that happens at Guantanamo. And I sort of set out to do, to find in my reporting the ways in which Guantanamo was and wasn't like other prisons, mm-hmm. because these conditions are familiar, the relationships and the struggle is familiar. And it turns out that a lot of that goes on at Guantanamo. So it was a tense time during this testing. One of the things that's immediately notable about Guantanamo is you don't have guys fashioning shanks or knives. There have not been a lot of very serious attacks on guards. The detainees rile the guards. They provoke them. They upset them in part by throwing cocktails of bodily excrement and urine at them, by hitting them with flip-flops. If you look through the hundreds of reports on these incidents that I've looked through, you find that most of them are almost sort of silly. But they do, I think, genuinely unnerve these young kids who are down there, who are told that they're guarding the most dangerous terrorists on Earth. So there's already a kind of an imbalance and a tension that's just in the air.
I think the public vision of Guantanamo in many dimensions is still frozen back in the old Camp Zero days, where we had, you know, hooded men in orange jumpsuits shackled to the floor in open cages. How has that detained, imprisoned population evolved in the years since those first images came out of Guantanamo?
Well, that's right. I think that the Camp X-ray, as it was called, the view of things was really in some ways indelible to the enormous frustration of the military, because they feel like the improvements that they've made, and there have been many from that period, have been lost on most Americans. But part of what has transpired is that the population at Guantanamo has sort of changed, and the detainees, you know, these are not necessarily the detainees whom Donald Rumsfeld told you about. Whomever has described them, they've tended to be stick figures, either poor Afghan farmers or, as General Richard Myers once put it, you know, these evil terrorists who would gnaw through the hydraulic cables of an airplane to bring it down. And you've now had 760-some men pass through Guantanamo. More than 300 of those have been released. And the population has changed. You have a much more Arab population. You still have 100-odd Afghans. But all of the Europeans are gone. A lot of the other people who were seen to be less of a threat have been sent home either for continued detention or release. And the population, I think, has coalesced to a degree people don't necessarily realize, which is not to say that everybody in there is an Al-Qaeda terrorist. I mean, it's become much clearer who is there and who is not and who these people are.
But not exactly clear how to deal with men when their fate, the prospect of a trial, when, what kind of trial, if ever they get a trial, is so up in the air. That makes it very unlike most, let's say, American prisoners. I want to get into these details, but I want to invite our listeners in as well. Paul's calling from Washington, Connecticut. Hi, Paul, you're on the air.
Hi. I have some experience. I did some business in Guantanamo years ago, so the terrain to me reverberates because I have the image of where these people are. Mm-hmm. Also, I have a World War II experience, but I have been in several prison camps. And
As a prisoner or guard?
Prisoner.
So you were a POW in World War II?
No, I was in a concentration camp.
Okay, got it.
I was in four of them. I was in Auschwitz, Buchenwald, Berga, and Zeitz.
So you've got a lot of experience. All right.
And in one of them, I was at Berga with GIs. And let me tell you, this thing, to keep these people without access to a judicial, open judicial process and to observe the convention, it's a nightmare. Can you imagine Americans being captured overseas and being dragged through the streets? I mean, it's just awful. I don't understand why the Bush administration doesn't just move on.
But, Paul, what about the president and others who say, look, we've got a serious threat to national security here. This is not like prisoners of war in conventional warfare. We have to take new, different, extreme measures because of an extreme threat. What do you say to that?
We have agencies in this country because of the balance of power. You have the judiciary. let these people be treated according to the laws of this country. Try them. Get it off the table. This is not somebody. I mean, you walk out of your living room and you say, "Oh, I want to take vengeance out of these people." And you hit them in the head. You can't do that just because you're a president.
We've got an American way, American laws, and international standards. Paul, thanks for calling. Tim Golden. There's a voice from Auschwitz saying, "Let's keep this within the law." What's your sense of commanders and guards at Guantanamo? Would they like to see this drawn into international, national law, or do they think they've got to do something different?
I think the uniform military, really from the top down, is comfortable with the international legal standards to which they have trained for the last almost 60 years, and that's the Geneva Conventions. You see this now with the JAGs who are testifying on Capitol Hill. It's been going on behind the scenes for months, in which you've had a struggle between administration officials, particularly administration lawyers and senior lawyers on the administration side. I'm sorry, military side.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's what the military is comfortable with. But you clearly have a dilemma here, and the fact that so many people in the United States are upset about this is also a source of leverage for the prisoners. They have access to lawyers. They understand that this is a very shaky ground for the military to be on, and they try to use that.
Mike Gardner, Colonel Bumgardner, said to you, how do you deal with an individual whom the President of the United States and the Secretary of Defense have called the worst of the worst? How did he try to deal with his prison population? There were hunger strikes that he had to deal with, and worse. What was that negotiation like? How did he pursue it? How did he try to make a relationship with a prison population like this one?
Well, it was a very striking sort of rhetorical question that he posed. I'm supposed to treat these people humanely, yet the president himself has already labeled them the worst of the worst, or the Secretary of Defense.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did was to go out in his kind of North Carolina good old boy way to some extent and try to talk to people. I think he's very comfortable dealing with people one-to-one. And he did something that was extraordinary enough to shock many of his staff officers. He started sitting these guys down for longer conversations about what the problems of the prison were. He found initially the detainees who spoke English, who had some apparent influence among their brethren. And he began kind of going through the problems. And the way that unfolded was really striking. I think the detainees were as shocked as some of the guards about what was going on.
That a commander would speak with them and speak with them at some length.
He would bring them to a place called Juliet Block, where the International Committee of the Red Cross representatives sometimes meet with detainees. And he would sit them down at a picnic table and start talking about what was going on at the prison and what could we do to make things better, and making very clear that what he wanted in return was their compliance with the rules.
Was it possible to get that compliance when there was no clear end game for these prisoners? I mean, in a normal, let's say, American prison, there's, you know, the chance of getting out or the certainty of getting out one day, and maybe getting out early for good behavior. So even some pretty bad characters can give decent behavior, compliance, as you put it. Is that a possibility when there's no end game exactly?
Well, that was the question at the center of the story and at the center of Colonel Bumgardner's experience, because initially, as he got to more and more influential and important detainees, they got more coherent and clearer in their demands. And one of the things that they pushed for was an application of Geneva Convention standards on things like discipline, where you can only discipline a prisoner under Geneva 3 for 30 days, on things like the quality of the food, the freedom of worship. The Geneva rules for prisoners of war are very elaborate, and they include things like allowing the distribution of musical instruments and scientific equipment. I think Colonel Bumgardner thought from the beginning that those kinds of things were never going to happen at Guantanamo. But the question that General Hood put to him was, well, let's see what we can do. Try to figure out what's possible here. And I think it was to some extent a great surprise because they knew how big this movement was. They knew what a change it represented to have this kind of dialogue. Mm-hmm. I think they were quite surprised at the response that they got from the detainees.
And yet hunger strike came back. Suicide came again. Joe's calling from Silver Spring, Maryland. Joe, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. First long-time listener, first-time caller. Joe Williams here.
Oh, Joe, great to have you. What do you think?
How are you doing? Well, I have two quick questions. Number one, Tim, how did you get access to this? I mean, was this all records? I read the article. It was fantastic. Was it all access? Did they give you more access than most reporters have been getting? And I'll take the call off the air.
Joe, thanks. Tim, you had 100 interviews into this. Where and how did you get this inside picture? And then what do you see coming?
Well, I started to get a sense that these negotiations, which the military denied having even taken place, were a more serious thing. And I went to Afghanistan to interview the former Taliban ambassador who was part of him. He was the only detainee who had been involved in the talks who had been released. Mm-hmm. I went to the Middle East. I hunted down former guards and intelligence people around the United States. And I pieced this story together as well as I could. And then in the end, after many, many conversations, including several in Guantanamo, I got Colonel Bumgarner to tell this story in more detail.
Paul is calling from Urbana, Illinois. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm curious about what our Attorney General said the other day. He said, we're more concerned about the detainee trials because we can keep them indefinitely anyway. And we're more concerned about the torture and what the CIA can do and whether they can waterboard or not. And I'm looking at a Brennan Center for Justice article about this, and basically the Warner bill is not that very good. It still allows the undermining of habeas corpus. It has a language in there about persons instead of citizens as far as being protected, so it's the Padilla Clause. So that
this is Senator John Warner's answer to President Bush,
right.
And what,
so,
for you, you'd like even more standard treatment than that?
Yes, I would, and I'd like to see more discussion of it. So, because it's being characterized as this big rebellious act, and it is a rebellion because Bush has been getting his way on everything in the Senate. I mean, the Constitution, for heaven's sake, says that it is the duty of the Congress to decide about policies of holding people captured on land and sea.
So you're talking about a GOP rebellion, but it doesn't go far enough for you. Let me get one more voice with us here, Paul, and we'll turn to it with Tim Golden from Watertown, New York. Carl's on the line. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hi. The point I'd like to make here, and it's lost on the American public, I think, is that these people are not prisoners of war, and the Geneva Conventions generally apply to prisoners of war. There are lawful combatants more like pirates that non-state actors that kill and do destruction.
And Carl, I see a note here that you're a reserve JAG officer yourself. Do you find that a widely held sentiment among military attorneys?
I think it is, yes. So with my thing here, that the American public doesn't understand the distinction between POWs and these unlawful combatants that do not belong to an armed force. Because, of course, if they're POWs, they go home when the war is over.
And when will the war be over? Let us pick up these two perspectives. Tim Golden here, Paul calls from Urbana saying, let's lay out even more rights for these prisoners. Then Carl says, look, these aren't POWs. These are unlawful combatants. They're pirates. It has to be different. Take us back to the crew on the ground running this camp. How do they see it? Mike Bumgarner, for example.
Well, I think I would approach it a little bit differently. I think mm-hmm. Paul alluded to a very important point here, which is that we're starting to have this debate on a national level. We didn't really have it in the aftermath of 9/11. These policies were put in place by a very small group of administration officials working in secret in many instances. Mm. And you now have a situation in which some of these issues, how we're going to try people, are coming up. But in fact, we're really only going to try a tiny fraction of the men at Guantanamo. And that doesn't include, of course, others, 500 now being held at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. There may be people that we want to hold indefinitely who are captives in Iraq. So the second gentleman's point, the reserve JAG officers, mm-hmm. absolutely right. The only rules that we have are EPW, enemy prisoner of war rules, and these men are clearly not that. One of the things that has come through after all of the congressional and court fights is that the administration's basic, the basic plank of the administration's military approach to fighting terror, which is that we can hold people indefinitely under the laws of war, has not been undermined. It has not been overturned. So that's going to continue. And then the question comes to the guys on the ground at Guantanamo, how are we going to do that?
Well, I mean, and here's where the moral quandary seemed to come in for these men, for Colonel Bumgarner. There's a relationship here, and you describe it. It's a very intimate relationship between these guards and prisoners over time. Describe for us the kind of moral quandary that they found themselves facing as it's resolved into clarity in their minds, in Colonel Bumgarner's mind.
Well, one of the amazing things that happened under his tenure was that in these continuing series of conversations, he sat down with a man named Shocker Ammer, detainee 239, as he is known, and he was a guy who was called the professor by
Saudi,
the guards.
Very fluent English speaker, had spent time in the UK and the US, as I recall.
That's right. He'd worked in a coffee shop outside Atlanta, and he had been an interpreter for American military forces in the first Gulf War in Saudi Arabia. And he had emerged as a very important leader of the detainees. And he and Colonel Bumgarner spent hours together. And the colonel said something that I found extraordinary, which is in the course of these conversations, this guy really emerged to him as a person and somebody he thought, I can deal with another human being. I can understand this guy. I can sort out with him if he really does have the influence that he claims to have and the ability to deal with other influential leaders in the camp, a way through these problems that they faced.
Now, this was urgent because at some points we had big hunger strikes going on there. So there was a real moral issue and publicity issue, what Admiral Harris later called asymmetric warfare when some of these prisoners killed themselves.
That's right. In late June of 2005, you had the first really wide-scale hunger strike start on a sustained basis. And by the end of July, you had more than 50 hunger strikers. And it was at this point that Colonel Bumgarner turned to Shocker Ammer to try to shut off the hunger strike and got him out of his cell, took him around with him to the maximum security area and allowed him to speak to other influential detainees one by one to try to persuade them to stop the hunger strike. And they did. The hunger strike ended on July 28th, 2005. They issued in what Colonel Bumgarner called the period of peace, in which they started talking about all sorts of things, the food, the conditions under which these men were held. He had already made a whole lot of kind of minor cosmetic reforms to make life easier for the detainees.
The Star-Spangled Banner being played at prayer time for the detainees had them upset.
Yeah, well, the Star-Spangled Banner, which is retreat and also reveille, would play on the Navy bases PA system, and meanwhile the call to prayer would sometimes be going on in the Guantanamo, in the detention camps PA system, and the detainees were extremely upset about this, feeling like there was this sort of competition or they were being drowned out. The detainees are largely, many of them are very religious men and extremely sensitive to what they perceive to be the disrespect of their faith by some of the guards.
So a period of peace, but it didn't last. Peter's calling from Davenport, Iowa. Hi, Peter, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I think my concern here is that we have lost so much credibility in the world. I mean, we know now about CIA secret prisons, and a big issue for me is when Colin Powell stepped up to the plate and said, we have to adhere to Common Article 3. If we don't maintain this standard, we're going to lose even more ground.
What about the same question for you, Peter? What about when there's an acute threat? What about the president saying, this is different? These men are not like standard prisoners of war, and we have to treat them differently. Do you agree?
I disagree. I think that the administration is very good at putting a spin on words and creating new words, and that they've used the term terrorism essentially to justify everything else they've wanted to do, and I just don't buy it anymore.
Peter, we've got it. And there, a salute from Peter to General Colin Powell. Let's go to Washington, D.C., and Christine. Hi, Christine. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question that that's been bothering me since this whole issue of the president wanting to redefine the Geneva Convention. I haven't heard anybody suggest, why don't we go back to the original convention, the original signatories, and have a meeting of minds of everybody. The U.S. isn't the only one signed on to this. This was created by a lot of different countries. Why not go back to them and say, things have changed, this is a new situation, times have changed, and have a meeting to redefine and not have, and I don't believe it's correct or right for the U.S. to step in and say, we want to redefine this.
Unilaterally, so to find out if there's a community of thinking, a new community that would look at a new kind of challenge. Tim Golden, can you imagine that? I mean, you mentioned some of the things that now could sound arcane, the right to musical instruments and scientific instruments. Could you imagine the world stepping back up to the Geneva Conventions and saying, we need to change these in an era of terrorism?
Well, that has very much been a subject of discussion going back. The International Committee of the Red Cross, which in some sense has a charter to implement and oversee the conventions, has tried to have some of those discussions going back several years. Mm. And the world, I think that the international community, in particular European allies of the United States, have talked about that. Because remember, the administration has really focused in the first few years of this period on new rules of interrogation. They didn't want these unlawful combatants, as they called them, to be exempt from interrogation, as enemy prisoners of war mm-hmm. generally are under the Geneva Conventions. I mean, you can question people, but they can also not answer. It's mm-hmm. it's somewhat like our
name,
criminal
rank,
justice
and serial
system.
Number. Yeah,
exactly. And they wanted to have access to the information that these men might have, and they wanted to be able to use the techniques that they thought were going to get it out. But when you get down to what the treatment was, well, the president promised when he essentially set aside the Geneva Conventions in the fight against terrorism that we would treat people humanely to the extent consistent with military necessity, and a directive to that effect went out by from Secretary Rumsfeld. We just haven't really defined in this complicated situation in which we have presumptively labeled most of these men evil terrorists, what kind of humane treatment they deserve. And that's, again, you know, comes back to the situation on the ground in Guantanamo that has been largely out of view. What does constitute humane or rightful treatment? And once that becomes something that we're going to get little glimpses of, what are we satisfied with? What are we comfortable with?
But very hard to get a new international consensus on this, but perhaps worth a try, as Christine says. Let's take a call from Fairfax, Virginia. Mohammed is on the line. Hi, Mohammed. You're on the air.
I travel around a great deal and I have a big network. And all I can say is that this Gitmo thing is the best advertisement for America's enemies. Because you are now, the Americans are now the modern Nazis, and Gitmo is the Auschwitz. And I think General Powell was quite right. America's moral standing is gone.
But what about alleged terrorists? I mean, there's a certain moral problem there as well, isn't there?
No, there isn't any moral problem. Most of these people who were in Gitmo were picked up and were victims of warlords, and they were not even charged. A very small number of them actually were al-Qaeda people. And they're being released, these guilty, non-guilty ones, and they're making speeches around the world and just said, this is what America stands for. And honestly, you know, it's terrible what this is doing to America's image.
It's certainly been rough. Tim Golden, what about the characterization, the proper characterization of the population at Guantanamo today? The president recently sent these 14 sort of high-value detainees there. But, Mohammed says, no, these in general are just, you know, guys picked up here and hither and thither. How would you describe that population?
Well, I think we're starting to understand that it's very diverse and complex population, and many of the people who have been let out clearly have been people that the administration has not been able to put evidence up against in a way that's convincing. They're talking now. I mean, I hear from military sources that you know, some few dozen people really have strong cases against them for the military commissions. And given that so many, that there have been a lot of mistakes, and I think there have been a lot of guys who the administration has not wanted to hold, that raises a lot of questions about those who remain. One of the things that's really happened behind the scenes, I think, is that the administration has said, okay, there's a risk of sending these people home, but how many new Saudi terrorists are we going to create by leaving the 100 Saudis in there? And how many, and what's the danger of sending those men back to their home country? I mean, the calculus has really changed as the political and public relations problem that Guantanamo represents internationally has grown and grown.
With risks in both directions, Colonel Baumgartner's effort at peace with the prisoners finally failed. Why?
Well, I think the prisoners didn't play along with the same set of rules. I think their end game, as Joe Williams raised the question, was to get out and to bring as much pressure as they could to try to call attention to this idea that their indefinite detention without trial, without being charged, was not the American way.
Even to the point of mass or multiple suicide, which they ultimately organized and which brought out the asymmetric warfare comment that got so much attention, but three at one time.
Yeah, the suicides are an extraordinary story that's only really just begun to be told, but I think there was a situation in which some of the more hardcore hunger strikers ultimately became convinced that they needed to do something, that the hunger strikes weren't working, and the administration of the prison had taken very tough measures to try to break the hunger strike. And there were a series of suicide attempts in May at the same time that you had this riot that was described on NPR this morning. Mm-hmm. And then when those attempts, which were drug overdoses, were unsuccessful, three men got together on the same cell block and hung themselves without any of the other prisoners raising any kind of noise or alerting the guards, as they generally always had done before. In this case, people went along with it and may have been involved in organizing it as well, according to what I've heard from intelligence and military sources.
We've got just half a minute, Tim. You call it the Battle of Guantanamo in your piece. Who's winning?
Well, I don't think the United States is winning, in part because we haven't had a real debate, a real discussion in the country yet about how we're going to do this. It's been sorted out in a very ad hoc way by people on the ground, many of whom I think are well-meaning soldiers, but who don't have a clear set of rules for how they're supposed to proceed.
You've described those soldiers on the ground saying they can't believe it's being left to them to decide. It's amazing reporting and an amazing story. Tim Golden, we're very grateful to you for being with us. Thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter Tim Golden. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.